What's the most important resource that you have? If you really thought about this deeply, I think you'd come to the same conclusion that Joey and I did. It's time. In our newest book, Wealth Without Wall Street, The 3 Steps to Financial Freedom Through Passive Income, we talk about how are we tracking that time? What is the thing that we can do to get more of that time back?
That's right. If you've ever been listening to our podcast and thought, man, it would be amazing if I could take all the things that you guys have learned over the last 10 years and just summarize them, put them in some way to easily digest them and take action, that's what this book is all about. You're not going to want to miss it. Go to wealthwithoutwallstreet.com/new book and get your copy today.
Welcome to the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast, your guide to understanding how to get out of the Wall Street rat race and start your own mailbox money lifestyle. Now, don't let these handsome Southern draws fool you. These financial minds are teaching our country to enhance savings, increase cash flow, and create passive income, all without the help of Wall Street. Are you ready to break through? Now, here are your hosts, Russ Morgan and Joey Murray.
Stallion.
Yes.
You were working hard this morning. I was excited to see you there at 5:45.
Man, you have no idea how hard it is for this guy to get up that early and get out there and mix it up with trail mix.
If you don't know what we're talking about, every Friday I go to this workout class and it is like outside, it's running around, it's cardio, it's lifting weights, it's like the circuit training. And today Joey shows up, game on. By the way, it was kind of weird because we were supposed to partner up and you were running late and I didn't really know you were going to come. And so this guy had walked up to me and said, hey, you want to be my partner? I'm like, yeah, hey, I'm Russ. You know, he's telling me his name. I'm Blake. I'm like, okay, cool. And so we're running and kind of doing the warm up and there comes Stallion, you know, like ninth. Like right at the last minute, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get out of the partnership with Blake?
I put you in an awkward position.
I was like, it was sort of kind of like, you know, back in middle school, like whenever, you know, you got on a team, but then their friend shows up and they're like, I'm sorry, you can't be on our team anymore. And I was like, man, that kind of stinks.
I'm just thinking how little faith you had in me, number one, and two, how quickly you moved on. I mean, I hope I don't screw up in our business somehow that you just like immediately partner up with somebody else.
Yeah, I didn't figure out what Blake does for a living. Is he a better speaker, you know? I mean, I'm not certain about Blake, but it worked out. We were able to pass him off. He went on to another guy, seemed to be happy.
Yeah.
He wasn't angry at me.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, these childhood stories. It reminds me because today's episode, we're going to get into something that actually is sort of close to my heart in the fact that we're talking about mobile home park investing.
Right.
And I have not invested in mobile home parks, but I did live in one. I don't know if you knew this about me.
I recently heard this story. I had no idea.
Yeah. So my mom and dad split when I was in the first grade and she had been, you know, whenever she graduated high school, they got married shortly thereafter. Shortly thereafter, they had my sister. And so she did some school throughout, but really, you know, working, being a mom, didn't have time to go to college. That was not, in that time frame, was really not a big, huge priority for a lot of women. And when her and my dad split, she really knew that she needed to go and finish her degree in order to get a sustainable job to support our family. So she thankfully had a friend who owned a mobile home park or a mobile home in a park in a college town in Auburn. And we went and lived there for 1 year. My mom literally took like a year and a half to 2 years worth of courses in like a 9-month period of time. And so she really left me and my sister, who was 6 years older than me at the time. So my sister was like, what, 8th grade? I'm 2nd grade. And we were kind of managing ourselves. You know, it's great to have an 8th grader, you know, managing your household, as I think about my daughter doing that right now. But I just remember the time being in that, and lots of interesting stories happened during that time. I mean, my mom was on food stamps. I mean, that's how, like, literally she couldn't work because she was doing so much school in order to try to finish that year because she had a job lined up at this private school to teach, and it had to be done. I can remember it was weird to me because I didn't understand it all in 2nd grade, but we would go to the grocery store like 10 o'clock at night. Wow. And I'm like, Mom, why are we going to grocery store at 10 o'clock at night? And she's just like, oh, it's easier at night. Don't worry about it. And what I found out later is because she was really just so embarrassed
right.
that she was having to pay for food with food stamps. You know, not a whole lot of people know this about my mom, and I really want to just thank her again for what she did, the sacrifices she made early on. And from that standpoint, you know, my sister and I never wanted for anything. And I think of, well, our guest today, Andrew, is going to be talking about investing in mobile home parks. Not only is it a great opportunity for us as investors for passive income, but it also is providing affordable houses for those out there who really need it.
And right.
for us, at that time frame, we had very little money, if any. It was an awesome place for us. So anyway, I want to jump into today's episode because I think you're going to enjoy not only Andrew and his background, but you're also going to enjoy the opportunity sharing with us and how we may be able to participate and look at maybe this as a different alternative for us and what we're trying to do as far as creating cash flow investing. Let's get to the interview.
Andrew, welcome into the show today. So glad to have you on Wealth Without Wall Street.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's awesome to have somebody in here that can share a different side of real estate. We've talked a lot about multifamily, even some residential stuff, lending, but we haven't got into your area of expertise on the mobile side.
Yeah, I would say it's arguably the sexiest asset class out there. Manufactured housing and mobile home parks are just, you know, it's palm trees and diamonds.
Well, our listeners know, Andrew, that I'm from a small town here in Alabama called Montgomery. And in Alabama, that's like the butt of all jokes. You want to make fun of anybody, Montgomery is where they go to. So, you know, the majority of my friends and people that I knew growing up, you know, lived in mobile homes and exited them during the fall when we have tornado season. So,
right.
Well, Andrew, I'd love for you to share a little bit of your background. I think you have one of the most compelling stories we've heard in a while, besides the fact of you being a lookalike for Sean Astin in the movie Rudy. Maybe you could shed a little light on how you got to where you're at and your background.
I won't deny that I am or am not Sean Astin, so we'll just start there. Yeah, so I'll just give you some quick bullet points on my background. So I grew up on the East Coast. I was in Los Angeles for about 20 years. I'm currently in Phoenix, Arizona, where we're based here now, and we have an office here. I've been here about a year, but I was in Los Angeles for 20 years. And essentially, I was in the entertainment industry for a fairly long time, about 20 years. And I worked for a company called William Morris for 16 years. And if you guys have ever seen the show Entourage on HBO, that essentially was the company. So Ari Emanuel was my boss, you know, fancy Beverly Hills office. And we essentially were the biggest talent agency in the world. And we would represent everyone from Steven Spielberg to Taylor Swift to my niche was comedy and music. So my clients were like Peter Frampton and Styx and Dennis Miller, Tim Allen, Whoopi Goldberg, Andrew Dice Clay. So really interesting gig. And they certainly, you know, you kind of come up through the ranks and they pay you pretty well. And you're dealing with A and B list celebrities. And it's like anything else that's in corporate America. I mean, you're dealing with all kinds of politics and all kinds of BS. But at the end of the day, it's a really pretty high profile gig. So it's one of those jobs that you get into and generally people never leave. They're going to retire from there, or maybe they make a lateral move to another agency, or maybe they go run a film studio or something like that. So that's basically what I did for about 16 years. And it was a really good run, but you know, all things come to an end sometimes. And that was, we can kind of talk about transitioning out of there. Do you guys want me to touch on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, I'm interested. You mentioned a lot of names there. Like first you started with comedy and you gave Peter Frampton and the Styx that followed that. And then you went into Whoopi Goldberg.
Yeah.
Before going into Dennis Miller and some others. I mean, that's
are you picturing them all on stage together?
Yeah. That would be awesome. I mean, I think of some of the stories and things that you, just life lessons that you had from those interactions with that group of people.
Yeah, it's funny. I was trying to think if there's a really good story to share, and I'll share one if I can think of one that I can legally share. But it's interesting when you're dealing with celebrities. You know, like I worked with Lily Tomlin for for a while, and my mom was a big Lily Tomlin fan. So there were times that, or, you know, I met and had dinner with David Hasselhoff once. Never represented him, but, you know, I called my dad the next day. I'm like, Dad, I had, you know, I hung with Knight Rider, you know, and he's like, oh, he's like, I kind of understand what you do now. Not really, but so a lot of it's like, how can I, you know, how can I let mom and dad, you know more about what I'm doing? But celebrities are, I guess they're just like anyone else. You know, there's nice ones and not so nice ones and a lot of ego. And what's interesting is if you look at your career as kind of a, you know, I guess kind of an arc. I mean, you've got people that are on the way up and on the way down. And if you've got a celebrity that's, their star is falling, most of the time they're blaming everyone else, right? So it's their team, it's their manager, it's their agents, their business manager. It's never their fault. So you've got, you know, just these interesting dynamics when you're working with people. You know, someone could literally be making $100,000 a night doing something and wake up the next day and want $250,000 for no reason, just because they feel they're worth that value. So you've got a, you know, you've got a lot of interesting scenarios and situations like that.
Yeah, I did that last night, actually. You know, I was thinking the same thing. So thank you for for bringing
just
that up.
Put it on your dream board and it'll happen.
I must stay away from that, Jerry. I could go in plenty of directions.
That was a softball. I just lobbed that one up for you.
This is still a family show, so I'll avoid the innuendo that you kind of alluded to there. But so from an investment perspective, Andrew, you're sitting there, you're talking with these guys. Obviously, your goal was to help them get gigs and to put them in front of the right people. But I'm sure you probably also had some interesting conversations with them about what they were doing with money, I would imagine.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, a lot of the time, and depending on the level of talent or what kind of a celebrity, but a lot of the time their business managers are really working on that. I didn't meet too many people that were very, very hands-on with what they were doing. A lot of people, sadly enough, you know, they really rely on putting money in the market, and just like everyone else does, right? I mean, they don't necessarily have a 401k they can contribute, but they're, you know, they're putting money into the market and certainly not alternative assets. So
yeah, well, it's funny that you say that, because see, the listeners of this show are big into control. They want to be, you know, informed, involved, and the thought of just giving money to somebody else and not knowing what's happening is foreign to them, and it's really why they gravitate toward, you know, people just like yourself who come on and can share alternative asset classes that they can get involved in, they can be informed in, and they can be educated as they go along. It's funny that you say that. I guess you can see that in some people. Was there any of them that you dealt with that seemed to be more hands-on, or were they all pretty, like, you know, just everything there is, they didn't want any piece of it?
It was definitely the minority. I mean, that's really why, you know, you could almost have the same argument. Well, why do you have an agent, right? Why don't I just go do the work myself? Well, at the end of the day, you know, you only have so many hours in the day. And if you have a good manager and a good agent, a good business manager, and a good tax, you know, account and all that stuff, I mean, you have a team around you. And when you're a celebrity and you're making millions and millions of dollars, that's a pretty crucial part of your business. So, I mean, that's the philosophy. So I would say definitely the minority in terms of who's hands-on with some of their investments, or there may be a situation where someone is buying a winery in a small circle and they all go in and someone has to, you know, a business manager has to, you know, quote unquote, vet it or whatever they're going to do. But generally, they've got people that are telling them, hey, put X amount of dollars into this. And, you know, they're not out buying single family houses on their own, right? I mean, I'm sure that's happened. But it's absolutely the minority, not the majority.
You don't think Whoopi Goldberg's out there like researching rental properties or something?
Like flipping apartments. I doubt it.
She's on Zillow right now researching.
She's like, we're at the top of the market.
Andrew, so I'm not sure if this applies to your transition or not, but was there something about what you were learning at that time about mobile home parks and that attracted to you this? Like, if so, what were those things and how did that make that exit from what you knew so well, 16 years doing what you were doing, 20 years, to now being with Four Peaks Partners and what you do?
What happened was it really started around the subprime crash. I had all my money tied up in the market, which I'd say the majority of my colleagues did. I mean, that was just the norm, right? You're putting money into Wall Street, into a 401k. Maybe you're managing a portfolio of stocks or something if you're really hands-on, but very few people were buying, at least in the world I was in, was buying real estate or anything in the alternative asset class. So the crash happens. My parents, who had been retired and moved to Florida, they lost a pretty significant part of their retirement. And, you know, dad was a retired plumber, mom was a retired nurse, raised three kids, lower middle class. And so, you know, basically sitting there scratching my head and saying, how does that happen? Right? They quote unquote did everything right, saved their money, trusted advisors and everything. And they got hit pretty hard. So that basically led me to starting to read a lot of books on economics, and it all led me into real estate. I'd read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, like, you know, like a lot of other people, and a lot of other books. And it led me to real estate investing. And I think the first thing that you do when you, you know, when you start that journey is you tend to look in your backyard for deals. And so I'm in Los Angeles, and even after the crash, you know, 2009 time period, it was really expensive, right? So if you're looking for, I was like, well, I need cash flow and I need to, you know, shift my money out of the market, start buying assets. And so looking in Los Angeles, it's like nothing made sense, right? Just it was overpriced. And California notoriously has been that way. Maybe you hold something for, you know, 10 or 20 years and you're going to see some great appreciation maybe, but you're certainly not going to cash flow along the way.
Yeah, I mean, the real estate market in California is crazy to try to figure out. You go into certain areas and you see homes selling for $1, $2, $3 million that, for instance, here in Alabama, where we are, maybe would be $150,000 to $200,000 homes. At that.
Sure. $1 million bucks gets you a lake and a home and a, right, a whole community.
So your journey to, you know, leaving the kind of entertainment world and going into investing and then into where you are, I mean, that's a pretty interesting journey all along. How did you land eventually into the manufactured home space?
Yeah, so basically I found some mentors, and it was kind of what we were talking about earlier. There's a lot of people out there that are the quote unquote gurus giving you pretty bad advice. So I actually found some really good people to just meet with. And I started buying houses in Dallas, Texas in late 2009, which, you know, hindsight being everything, that was an unbelievable time to buy houses. So just as an example, $125,000 house in Dallas in 2009, that was, you know, four bedrooms, three baths, 10,000 square foot lot down the street from a good school, $125,000, maybe it was renting for $1,500 or $1,600, really good financing at that time. And 5, 6, 7 years later, that house has almost doubled in value, which was crazy. So I think Dallas had this huge upswing that typically really hasn't happened in Dallas. So, I mean, I just got really lucky that I, A, timed the market, and then I got into some really good markets. And so Dallas was one of them. This is all single family. Bought a lot of property in Memphis, and then bought a lot of property in Atlanta, and had a little turnkey company there with some partners who moved there. We were buying C-class, probably at $30 to $40 a square foot. We were doing a bunch of buy and hold, and we did some flips there. So a lot of investors, I mean, funny enough, they start with single family, and that was definitely my journey. And I did that from 2009 to about 2013, all while I was, and I bought over 100 homes, and it was all while I was still at William Morris. So once I got the bug, it was kind of game over. You know, it's like waking up at the crack of dawn, and, you know, I was working a lot of hours at William Morris, but my book ended my day with it. It was weekends. It was whenever I could. And once you, you know, I mean, buying single families in the right market isn't rocket science. So it's like, once you figure it out and you've got the capital and you've got the resources, and I could, you know, it's like everything else, you know, someone's like, hey, what's new? And you're like, well, I'm buying houses in Dallas, Texas, and 80% of people are going to look at you like you've committed murder. And then 20% are like, well, that's interesting. Tell me a little bit more. And so, you know, I started actually doing small deals, syndicating with friends and family, basically, who are like, that's really interesting what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in real estate, the keys are, right, you got to have access to money, you got to have access to deals. And sounds like you're having a lot of deal flow. You're getting plenty of access. At what point did you run into the, I don't have enough capital to make these deals happen?
Probably towards the end when I left. At that point, it was 2013. And a couple things happened. One is, I deployed a lot of my money, which was all really good investments. The second was the market was getting really expensive, and there were more and more people jumping in. And so all of the deals that I was buying in 2009, 2010, 2011, they just weren't penciling out for me. So I literally stopped buying. And that's kind of what led me into getting into the mobile home park world, is I really wanted the economies of scale. Single families are great, especially if you're cutting your teeth on that. But, you know, I really wanted to get into multifamily or something with economies of scale. Multifamily was one of the first things that we really took a good look at in 2013. We made some offers and we started putting a team together. And, you know, there's too many people chasing deals. The cap rates were, even back then, were getting compressed. And so really that was the big reason why mobile home park investing was so interesting, is there was less traffic in the space, but also there was a lot of moving pieces. So you had to really figure out, it wasn't like we're going to, you know, buy one building in Birmingham, Alabama, and we're going to find a property manager and we're going to, you know, renovate the units and rent them. I mean, it completely different model with a lot more moving pieces, which I think is also another reason why less people were in that space.
Gotcha. So give a little bit more meat on the bones as the year process with Four Peaks Partners, so that listeners, I mean, at the end of the day, we're looking for passive income to get financial freedom, freedom of time, freedom of our calendar, whatever you want us to call it. How does Four Peaks Partners do that? Partner with accredited investors. Give us a little bit more on your process and how they get involved.
Yeah, so I'll just take a quick step back. So we're in the manufactured housing and mobile home park business. That's the only asset that we're currently acquiring. We own about 1,600 units right now. It's 24 communities in 12 states. I think we're at 108 employees, 108 W-2 employees or something like that. So we've built a fairly big organization around this. And I'll give you guys a couple quick stats. One is that 50% of wage earners in the United States are making $30,000 or less. So that's a pretty, that's just an alarming statistic. So essentially most of, you know, the majority of wage earners, or half of wage earners, are making, you know, $27,000, $28,000 a year, or whatever that is. And the other is that it's some high percentage, like 60% have $1,000 of savings or less. So a lot of this boils down to affordable housing and the massive need for affordable housing in America. So we're not necessarily competing with single family home buyers. We're really competing more on like the apartment side of things. So our lot rents, which everyone at the community is paying, it's going to be anywhere from $200 to $300. And in our model, most of our residents are owners. So that means that anything that happens within their home, the stove breaks, the cabinet falls off, the handle falls off, whatever, that's all on them. And because of the way that we've structured it, and other operators do that as well, versus a completely rental model, you've got lower expenses. There's certainly lower management involved. There's still quite a bit of management, but less management. And it's a pride of ownership thing too. I mean, you've got people that own that house. They're going to stay longer, take care of it better. We would all agree, I would say, that owners in general take better care of real estate than renters. So in our model, they're owning their own homes. And our acquisition focus has been in the Midwest into the Southeast. So again, we're not buying parks in Malibu, California at $1 million a lot. I mean, these are they're very, very affordable. And so let's say you've got $200 to $300 a month for a lot rent, and all of these folks need financing for their homes, whether it's a Berkshire Hathaway company that does it. We have our own private lending fund. And that home payment is going to be somewhere around the same price as a lot payment. So, you know, you're looking at $400 to $700 total all in for a monthly payment if you're owning a home. And so as part of our due diligence, when we're looking at a market, we're really looking at what's a two-bedroom apartment going to rent for, what's a three-bedroom. You know, if we're in a market and a single-family home is, a median price is $113,000, that's great, because that means there really is a lot of need for affordable housing. If we bring in a brand new home, it's $45,000. We renovate a home, it's $20,000. But again, it's that, what's the monthly payment that that resident is paying? And typically that's $400, $500, $600, maybe $700 in a, you know, more expensive area.
Yeah, you've got a group of people that need it. I mean, I didn't realize the statistics were that off, 50% at $30,000 or less. That's pretty amazing. But that's really, as we're looking for alternative ways to put our money to work and really just add value to the world, right? When you see that there's that sort of need out there for that home, I love your model. As we started researching your company and having conversations with you before this podcast, I really thought your value add by buying the property and then making sure you guys are selling all the homes and not trying to manage the actual physical mobile home, that's brilliant, because there's where all the problems lie. We all, you know, we can have all the funny jokes and stuff to go around with that. But at the end of the day, we want to own the land because the land is limited, and you want to really be able to limit your maintenance costs and everything else. And your model, I think, really is pretty interesting that you guys saw that. What percentage of your parks do you guys actually own the actual physical unit? Because I know that there's a lot of them that you're acquiring and you're having to go through that. What percentage of the actual homes are you guys owning in your parks on average?
It's so different. It's case by case, but let's say you buy a 100-space park and it's 50% occupied. I mean, there could be 20 park-owned homes, which could be vacant or could be rentals. We bought a couple parks outside of Knoxville, and there was 125 spaces. Bought this October of last year, 125 spaces, and I think it was 80 homes that were park-owned homes, and a lot of those were rentals. So in that scenario, that's a really high percentage, probably one of the highest. In that scenario, we simply convert the residents, as many as we can, to owners, and it's by really presenting to them that, hey, you can own this home that you've been renting for the past 18 months, and you're going to have to come up with X dollars out of pocket, and here's the terms. And again, all of these folks need financing because no one is sitting on $20,000 in cash. So one of the companies that we work with is 21st Mortgage, which is a Berkshire company. They've got $8 billion out in loans with a 5% default, and their average FICO is in the mid fives, right? So again, these folks are not able to qualify for a single family home, nor do they have the down payment to do a single family. So it's less overall. And one thing that's interesting before I forget too is one of the biggest challenges, you know, you still have challenges with collections, just like any part of the affordable housing business, whether you're in multifamily or a single family. Like in Atlanta, we were absolutely in, you know, C minus class. One of the challenges is that some of these folks are having a hard time coming up with a down payment. So let's say you've got a used home at $20,000 and someone's got to come up with 10%. That's $2,000, which doesn't sound like a lot of money, but a lot of people just aren't sitting on that kind of cash that are our resident profile. So one of the things that's been something that we've just been working on is how do we solve this problem? And we're actually launching a foundation probably in the next 2 or 3 months where we'll go and raise money through the foundation and be able to offer certain residents. And we're figuring out the, you know, there's different laws and rules and, you know, hoops to jump through in each state, but be able to offer residents an interest-free loan to help them get into these places. So that's one way that we're going to solve, but that's a problem that I think most operators are running into. So on one side, you could be in the rental model where people are putting less money down. You're going to fill spaces faster because you're selling versus renting is a completely different absorption rate. But then now you've got a community full of renters, right? And the financing is tricky on that. You're going to have more damage to the homes. You're going to have more management. You're going to have more expenses, like all those things. So, you know, again, it's a lot different than multifamily because there's just a lot more moving pieces by selling.
All right. So I got to ask the question, though. When you're going to these parks, you know, everybody thinks of, okay, well, I'm going to deal with disaster when a tornado strike. How many parks have you guys own where tornadoes hit it?
We haven't had anything with a direct impact. We had when all the storms were happening in Florida, we have a park in North Carolina, and that got some weather, but it didn't really do very much damage other than taking down a couple trees. So we've stayed out of Florida. We've stayed out of South Texas. We've stayed out of Oklahoma. You know, we have a park in Kansas. Kansas has had tornadoes, but we haven't. So knock on wood, we haven't been that affected so far. But as part of your insurance and your overall strategy, I mean, you've got loss of rents in your policies. And I think if you're in an area, again, we haven't been through it yet, but if you're in an area where your community is just completely wiped out, you've got hopefully good insurance that's going to take care of some of it. You've got maybe FEMA that steps in to help. I mean, there are other ways, but we thankfully haven't been through it.
I want to jump in here, Andrew, and kind of shift the conversation a little bit, still obviously related, but there's some hesitation at what I hear in the market about the real estate market being a bubble, comparing today as 2007, like the precursor to the fall, recession, whatever you want to call it. I'm just curious, you're so tied into this. What are your thoughts on that? What either makes that viable or not, in your opinion?
Yeah. So if you take a step back and you look at the big picture, I feel like arguably in certain markets around the country, we're probably at the top, or some markets have kind of peaked. Like Dallas is a great example. Prices are still climbing there. I mean, you look around, it's just simply cap rates at multifamily. I mean, you know, 2009, 10, 11, maybe you were picking stuff up at 8 caps or 10 caps or whatever that was. Maybe it's C-class a little bit higher. Now you're looking at, you know, 4 caps, 5 caps. If you're looking at California, it's a lot less. So on a cap rate standpoint, what we're buying right now is typically in about the 8 to 10 range, 8 to 10 caps, maybe a 12 cap for a mom and pop. And it depends on the occupancy and a number of variables. But I feel like a lot of other asset classes have reached the point where either people have stopped buying, and I know people with big portfolios that are literally stopped buying and they're selling. I mean, someone comes in and offers you 3.5 cap on, you know, certain properties, and it's hard to not really think about that and sell. So at some point, there's got to be a correction. We just don't know when it's going to happen and how severe it's going to be and what the lending, you know, what's going to happen in the lending markets. That certainly rates are starting to creep up, but you've got kind of these bubbles around the country, like Texas is a good example. Nashville, I think, is like really been increasing just year after year. Certainly California is out of control. DC, New York, I mean, all the typical markets, but it feels like there needs to be a correction at some point to kind of reset some of this stuff, because it definitely feels very bubble-like in some markets.
Well, I would think in your area too, Andrew, that you guys would feel pretty good about a bubble coming. If a bubble's going to help any market, tell me if I'm wrong on this, but that your area is going to be where people are going to fall to, right? I mean, you're going to have more people coming your way into the apartment, mobile home park arena than, you know, say the prime A, you know, new apartment units that are being built, which we see lots of that here in Birmingham. Yep. You're going to see people falling out of those, trickling down towards you, I would think.
Yeah, and we've got some pretty good data on that too. Just historically through a recession, these things are pretty resilient. But it's just like you said, it makes a lot of sense. Let's say you've got a family that's, let's say they're renting a house, right? And someone loses a job, there's a downturn. They're probably not homeless, but maybe they downsize. Maybe they're now in a 2-bedroom, or maybe they get a large apartment or whatever that is. So that kind of happens top to bottom. And below us is really like these transient RV parks. And then you're essentially living out of your car and you're homeless. So there's not too much room to go below us. And that's really part of the reason that we got into it.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing, again, you guys, your model, from what I understand it, is that you're looking to buy parks that you guys are going to own the actual dirt, sell as many of the units back. I love the thing that you mentioned about a foundation. It's going to help them be able to get the down payment, put that down so that they can become owners. I mean, we've worked in the real estate space. We love the idea of like the lease option so that you don't have to deal with maintenance. So obviously, if you make more people owners, then not only will they take better care of it, but you'll have less out-of-pocket costs. What are the big challenges in your space right now that you're seeing trying to acquire new parks and bringing on other investors to help in that process?
The big challenge, and it's what everyone else is seeing in other asset classes, there's a lot of capital that's sitting on the sideline looking for yield and looking for a good home. So there's more money that are chasing deals in this space than ever before, I feel like. My partner's been operating in this space since 2007, and you know, it resonates with him as well. So let's say you've got some of the big operators with, you know, people with 50,000 units, 100,000 units, they're probably just buying larger assets, let's say 300 plus size communities, 300 lots or above, and probably more stabilized communities. So let's say not much below 80% occupancy. In our world, we found kind of the niche within a niche, and that's to go after the 50 to 200 space communities. We're in secondary and tertiary markets. So the market has to make sense. There has to be job drivers there. There can't be a meatpacking plant 20 miles down the road, and that's the only job driver. There has to be some infrastructure there to do a 5 or 10 year hold. But we're certainly not in huge metros. We're in secondary and tertiary market. So we found this niche to go after kind of 50 to 200 space parks. And generally, what we're targeting right now is about 40, 50, 60, 70% occupancy, where in an investment model, we can hit a pretty decent pref the first 12 months, but with a lot of upside. So part of the reason why there are less people chasing those kinds of deals is they don't have the infrastructure to do it. I mean, I've got a construction company with 40 employees and a management company with, you know, the better part of 50 employees. So we've built out this infrastructure where we can go. We've got, you know, 5 traveling crews out right now at communities that are turning units, and we're bringing in new units. So, you know, if you're going to buy more stabilized stuff, then you've got more people chasing those deals. The cap rates are going to be lower because of it. And there may be less work, but it's going to be a challenge, and certainly not as much upside.
Yeah. So as we wrap up here, I'd love to kind of hear, and you've said a little bit of it, maybe in summary, though, kind of, you know, someone who's listened to the show who maybe know little about the mobile home park side, why is this a good space for them to be really researching to get involved in?
I guess the biggest reason is we've created opportunities for completely, I mean, our clients are absolutely passive investors. They're not looking for another job. They're maybe if they're in the real estate doing other things, they're taking their profits and they're coming in and placing with us in terms of a passive investment. So we've created a few different vehicles that offer pretty stable income as well as some growth. So it's kind of a hybrid model. And again, you know, our investors, they're generally pretty affluent people. They're running companies. They're not looking for another job. They're looking to place money and not have it out for 10 years. And so all of these things we kind of listened to over the years of what people are really looking for. They're looking for income. They're looking for stability. What happens when there's a downturn? How does that affect my capital? So really just through our investors, we've created a number of different vehicles that seems to be working pretty well for them.
So Andrew, let me ask you this just in closing here. How does someone get involved with Four Peaks Partners? What's the best process for that? And do we need to put a link on our show notes or walk me through that?
That would actually be great. So the website is fourpeakspartners.com, and I can get with you guys. I mean, we've got a lot of good literature and case studies and articles. So if someone wants to see some of that stuff, I can provide a link where they can go and get some of that information. It's, you know, it talks about why we're so bullish on affordable housing and specifically this asset class.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on and sharing. Definitely an area that our listeners probably doesn't have a whole lot of experience with. And you guys are doing a great job there. Really cool about the foundation. I'd love to be able to get more information from you on that and be able to put that in the show notes as well. So if you will go over to our show notes, we're going to have this on here. Love to have you to reach out to these guys if this is something you're interested in as well.
Great. Thanks for having me on, guys. Appreciate everything you're doing too.
Yeah, awesome. Absolutely.
All right, Russ, I have to say, Andrew absolutely takes the award for knowing the most celebrities of anybody we've ever had on the show.
The most celebrities, the most diverse group of people. I mean, he went from saying Dennis Miller to like Peter Frampton and then Styx. And then he threw in Whoopi Goldberg, bro.
Man, Whoopi Goldberg, I immediately could not help but start singing in my head that Sister Act song,
Ain't No Mountain High Enough, Keep Me From You. Well, when I think of Whoopi Goldberg, I think of Chris Rock and his special when he was talking, he did the bit on the top 10 reasons not to watch Whoopi Goldberg's new movie. And he's like, number 10, Jumpin' Jack Flash. Number 9, Sister Act 1. He goes all the way down. He's like, and the number one reason not to watch Whoopi Goldberg's new movie? Whoopi's in it.
Oh, that's brutal.
But I didn't want to throw that out there because, by the way, I, you know, obviously she's made a ton of money in the world and she has influenced a lot of people's lives. I won't get into the whole View and whether that's a good show or not. I don't watch it, but definitely interesting his background.
Yeah, he wasn't so tied into his career field and path that he was not willing to change. I mean, he said a lot of those folks just end up dying in that field, right? Just
yeah, when you're surrounded by celebrities, it's probably easy to get caught up into that and just continue on. I was intrigued just by his path as an investor. You know, went from single family, individually investing in things, then started looking into multifamily. You know, when he moved into the whole multifamily and then into mobile home parks, just because he was not, you know, tied into one idea, he was willing to go to where money was. And it didn't have to do with prestige because clearly investing in mobile home parks is not real sexy.
Right. It's not something you want to be sitting around talking about with all your buddies, but the strategies that they've employed and the processes and systems, I'm just really impressed with what they had to say.
Yeah, it's really cool. There's lots of lessons to be learned in that. Not only is there's money in the niches, riches in the niches, as they say, but also not being tied to just one specific thing.
And, you know, to tie this in, our next episode is all about networking for your business. And what do you think? I mean, Andrew mentioned many times that he was networking with people to find out what are they doing. And it was part of his research to get to where he is. So
from real estate brokers all the way to individuals at different events, who investors and everything else. I mean, people were constantly coming to him, and his ability to network and to create connections, that's what allowed him to expand. And that's what's going to allow you to expand in your business. And that's what we're getting into next week, is how do we grow our business? And one of the best ways is expanding our connections and the people that we know.
Now, listening to next week's clip, you won't want to miss this one.
You know, I actually had a situation where somebody said, well, yeah, I actually don't like them at all, but just out of convenience, I just keep using them, which I relate to, because there's a bank that I've done business with for 10 years that I would drop tomorrow, except for the fact it'd take me 2 weeks to unravel everything that I've got involved with, you know, all the direct deposits and stuff. I'm like, I don't want to deal with that. And that's where we are in life. And so when I actually went and met this 5-star CPA that was referred by a couple of people, I went back to the person who told me that they hated their CPA. And I said, you know what? I actually met a 5-star CPA, and legitimately, they are a 5-star CPA, and I connected those two people.
How cool is that?
It was awesome.
Yeah, you become the connector in that situation, which...
This has been the Wealth Without Wall Street podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show to break free of the Wall Street mindset and begin building wealth on your own terms in places you understand, so that your wealth will never run dry. See you next episode.